Lord Jellicoe, one. Now, you were at Trinity College, Cambridge, in, I think, the 3 years before the war started.
Correct, yes.
Can you tell me what the atmosphere was like then? And was there any kind of feeling that of European crisis, that a war was coming?
I was extremely apolitical in those days, and certainly I didn't. One was interested. I mean, I remember when I was at Winchester, I'd been very interested in what was the Abyssinian War. But quite frankly, I think, as far at least as I was concerned, I was more interested in my friends and having a good time and playing golf, and occasionally doing a little bit of work, very occasionally. And I was not sort of, I didn't feel tremendously involved in what was going on. One was, had a more than passing interest, perhaps, in the Spanish Civil War. And I'd been in Germany for my sort of gap 6 months. Therefore, I had some interest in what was going on, Nazism and the rise of it and all the rest of it. But quite frankly, I was not deeply involved. And I don't think great many of my friends were. But the great exception was, and what I'm saying is subject to this, was Munich. I think I became politically and internationally much more aware at that time than I had been beforehand. I felt very strongly about it. I remember going to stay with a great friend of mine, Archie John Wavell, the son of the Field Marshal, to stay with General Wavell, as he then was. I think he was Southern Command in Salisbury. And I remember feeling very strongly, right or wrong, about Munich, deploring it, feeling very ashamed of it. And I think a lot of my friends felt this. I had three very close friends at Cambridge. Mark Howard, the elder of the three Howard boys living at Castle Howard. And he then, or shortly afterwards, went on to whatever it's called, a supplementary reserve or whatever, of the Coldstream. And I think that may have had something for me to choosing the Coldstream as a parent regiment. And he was killed just before the Bocage. And another great friend was somebody called David Jacobson. And he was also much more politically aware than I was. A very remarkable person. He was killed. He joined the Tower Hamlet Rifles, the territorial part of the Rifle Brigade, and he was killed in the first retreat in 41 in the desert. Derna. But somebody else who was my third very close friend there was somebody called Peter Pease, and he joined the air squadron at the time. So I think all those three people in fact did something at that time, partly because they felt very strongly involved, and Peter Pease was shot down over Maidstone on the great day of the Battle of the Britain. When was it? 15th September, 40. So I in fact lost all my three close friends at Cambridge during the war. And another great friend, Archie John Wavell, he was killed in Kenya shortly afterwards in the Mama. But apart from that, well, I think the great awakening for me was Munich. Until then, I was certainly not conscious of tremendous interest amongst my contemporaries, maybe because of I was for some reason or not very politically involved at that time.
When did your course at Cambridge finish?
I finished at Cambridge, June 39. And I was going off after, the usual sort of post-exams. I was going off for the best part of a year abroad as I was reading for or hoping to get into the Foreign Service, Diplomatic Service. I was going off to France for the best part of 6 months and then to Germany.
Were you in France when war was
declared? No, I wasn't. Of course, it looked like things were coming there, going that way, and therefore it seemed pointless to pottering off and starting off there. I was fairly certain there was going to be a war.
Do you remember the actual day that war was declared?
Yes,
what you were doing?
I remember it very well indeed. I had spent most of those 2 days. We lived in the Isle of Wight at the time, and I spent, I think, September 1 and 2, travelling up and down from the Isle of Wight, and I'd taken my seat in the Lords by then, and listening a little bit to the debates. I remember very well indeed, I was up again. I was starting to feel rather like I felt at Munich. I thought we were going to rat on the Poles, and that hesitation about actually declaring war. I mean, as a young man, I didn't know really what was going on, but I was getting very worried about it. And I was in the house the morning when war was declared, and I remember very well those sirens going off, and I remember going to the shelters. I think it was in Parliament Square, I think. And that false alarm. And then I spent the afternoon with my friend David Jacobson. One could stay in those days at Claridge's as a young man for about £2.50, and I think I stayed that night at Claridge's. And again, I remember the sirens going off. And I also remember going down, one was feeling there was going to be gas attacks and all that sort of stuff. And I remember going down in the early morning to wherever the shelter was in Claridge's without my gas mask. I also remember a particularly shameful incident when one of the staff there remarked on the fact that I didn't have it, and offered to go up to my bedroom to get it. And I allowed him to go, thinking that he was more likely to... I preferred him be exposed to this imminent gas attack, which I thought might be coming, than I was. And as an atone for that, I felt really terrible guilty conscience when I realized the ghastly thing I'd done. I spent all the rest of the next day building, helping the staff to do the sandbags around carriages. As a result of which, for quite a long time after the war, I was able to stay. I was always get into carriages and was always allowed a very preferential rate.
Was carriages full of Americans?
No, I don't think so. No. Full of... Follow the usual old English clientele, I think.
So, did you feel some sense of relief when Chamberlain did declare war on the...
Oh, certainly, time? Certainly. Certainly I did. I was, I was getting terribly concerned that we were going to rat. There might be another Munich.
When did you actually join the Coldstream Guards?
Oh, well, I was a late joiner because I'd been, I forget what the thing was called. There was some sort of list which I was on, but it was a pretty vague list. And I spent the, I suppose I had about, there was a lovely September weather. We lived in the Isle of Wight, and it was the most beautiful I remember how absolutely lovely the weather was that summer, and I used to go down to the beach. There was a particularly attractive lady who'd rented the cottage on the beach, so I quite liked that. But one read the newspapers, one read about Poland. It was very depressing, and it was about 5 weeks, I think, before I actually went to Sandhurst to the Octu there.
What did you feel about the kind of instruction you got there?
Oh, I was only there for 2 months because I got pneumonia just before Christmas. So my training was extremely elementary. I was absolutely no good at all, and I got pretty bored with it, I think. I can't believe I was any good at all. My two most vivid memories of Sandhurst, which I rather enjoyed, we used to go up to... I remember the dormitory there. I think there were four in it. A great friend of mine was one of the people, somebody called Alan Hare, later became managing director of the Financial Times, and lucky chap in retirement. He has had, amongst other things, he was chairman of Chateau Latour. So I'm very glad that I've remained a friend of his. And there was somebody called Bobby Henderson. I was also, I think, not certain he was in our dorm. But Bobby Henderson's aunt used to own the Windmill Hotel, the Windmill Theatre. So we used to drive up occasionally to see the young ladies at the Windmill Theatre. It's extraordinary when you think what goes on in the theatre these days. I think they were allowed to uncover one bosom as long as they stood quite still. And this was this enormous erotic thrill we got. That's what I remember much more vividly of Sandhurst than anything else. I do remember, I can't have been any good, I do remember when I was actually drilling my squad or platoon, they professed not to hear my words of command and marched themselves into the lake there. And I also remember, I think it was somebody in the Coldstream, a captain or adjutant or something, telling me he didn't think that I'd be any good in the Coldstream. And I think he was probably quite right, too. So I don't think I was much good at Sandhurst. And certainly, I don't think I learned a great deal there.
But you had to interrupt it because of pneumonia.
How what?
You had to interrupt it because...
Oh, yes. And, yes. And then I saw an opportunity of not going on with... thing which I was getting rather bored with, so I joined a unit called the 5th Scots Guards, which was a ski battalion, and I'm a very keen skier, and I found that much more exciting and enjoyable, and we had a great number of my friends joined it. And we went off to train at Chamonix, which I had no objection to. And I think in the same way as the Russian fleet, when it went out to round the Cape of, you know, through the North Sea, sinking some fishing boats on the way, and then round the Cape of Good Hope, and then up to Tsushima, where they were destroyed, really, by the Japanese under Togo. They've always said you could follow their route by the number of champagne bottles. I think you could have followed the route of the 5th Scots Guards to Chamonix by the number of champagne bottles which came out of the trade. We were there for a fortnight only.
Were they destined to go to the winter war between Finland and Russia?
That's right. But var Norway, Sweden and the iron mines there, I've never quite understood what it was. And we, in fact, embarked in the port of Glasgow on board a rather fine Polish liner, the Battery, to go off. And we were all set to go when the Finnish armistice came. It was an extremely lucky thing for us that there was that armistice. I think our bones would be bleaching some sort of tundra very quickly. But it was a rather pleasant interlude, and I went straight away from that to our training battalion at Purbright. There I think I did learn a little bit, elementary field craft and that sort of stuff. But it was a pretty short interlude there.
And then the next step?
The next step was to go to the holding battalion, I think... of the Coldstream. It was partly in Duke of York's headquarters. First time I think I ever saw the Duke of York's. And then up by Regent's Park we were there. And I was there, you know, getting increasingly frustrated and impatient. You know, when the fall of France and all that, I didn't go to France, and all I remember was these wretched French refugees in the what's the place called, Earl's Court, where they have the great exhibitions, when they were evacuated. But I was only a pretty short time in the holding battalion. I remember playing ping pong. I also remember being confined to barracks.
Punishment?
I think, yes, for staying too late at the Bag of Nails and other nightclubs which one used to go to. And that's really what led me straight into the commandos, because I was getting very bored sitting on my ass. And then they started to form the commandos, and they called for volunteers from each guards battalion, or guards regiment.
How did you hear about the commandos?
I don't know. I suppose there was some notice posted up or something. All I do remember being interviewed down somewhere near Pont Street by then Colonel Laycock. He'd just been made a colonel, I think. And I was very unused to being interviewed. I mean, this is terribly gossipy, I'm afraid. One's been interviewed many times since, so one rather knows the form. But I wasn't prepared for the question, why do you want to join the commandos? And I could have told the truth, which I was bored with sitting on my arse and being confined to barracks in the holding battalion. But Bob Laycock saw that I was a bit inexperienced. And I always remember his question, the words he put in. I suppose, Jellicoe, you want to have a crack at the Boche. I suppose in a way I did, but it wasn't precisely what...
He prompted you with the right answer.
He prompted me with the right answer, yes.
But in any case, you were in.
Any case, I was in, and we did art in the... there was a troop from each... Guards regiment, and then from the 60th, number 8 commando we were in, which was what he commanded to begin with. And there was some, our troop was commanded by Mervyn Griffith Jones, famous barrister since. I think he made a captain. And then he had two subalterns under him, and one was Ian Collins the publisher's, who's about twice my age. He was getting on, Ian, but he'd played in the Davis Cup, a great tennis player, I.G. Collins. And I was the other subaltern in that. And then there were lots of sprigs or spriglets of aristocracy, like Gavin Astor and Julian Berry. And then there was some much more grander people of an older... Randolph Churchill was in our commander. There were grander people from, Lord Fitzwilliam and Bones Sudley, Lord Sudley. In fact, my future father-in-law, Philip Dunn, a racehorse owner. It was very much White's Club. Not that I was a member of White's Club, but it was very White's Clubby. But that was when I first met David Stirling, who was in the Scots Guards, troop, or whatever it was called, and where I also first met the person whom David always said he owed so much to in founding the SES, Jock Lewis, who was also in it.
What impression did David Stirling make on you as a person?
At that time, absolutely none at all. And when we went out to the Middle East in the Glengarry, all I remember about David Stirling at that moment, he was called the Giant Sloth, because he lay in bed in his cabin the whole way out there. We hardly ever saw him. That's what we called him. But then I think I did learn a bit of soldiering there, as we had a pretty energetic time down at Burnham and Crouch to begin with. Long marches and I think our well, certainly our commanding officer knew quite a bit about training, and we were toughened up. And it was a rather good thing. We had 3 weeks, periods of 3 weeks there, and then a weekend off.
Did many of them have to drop out because they couldn't take the physical exertion?
I don't think so. No, I don't think so. We had very, very, very few dropouts. I was only there for, I suppose, about 6 weeks. I remember so well driving up to London, you know, through the bombing. Not actually in the bombing, but the Mile End Road and things. It looked all pretty ghastly.
So this was the latter part of 1940?
No, this was Battle of Britain time. This was
the summer of.
This was August, July, August, September, 1940. I think sometime in September, I then went on a course to Lochilat, which again was commando training, rather good course, and again extremely sort of hard physically. There were. Shimi Lovett was the chief instructor, I think, there, Lord Lovett. Bill Sterling, David's brother, was also on the instruction staff there. There were amusing people like David Niven on the course. And there were some old boys. The one I knew best was somebody called Edward Beddington Behrens, a person who'd been in the First World War. We thought I rather befriended him, and I got on very well with him. He was a great financier, and he was actually up there because he was going to be in have a command in Sussex or Kent or something if there had been a successful German invasion, with the stay behind forces. So he was up there for that reason, and. Well, it was rather practical training. Some of it was deer stalking.
Living off the country.
Yes, and also poaching. Poaching Lord on the deer on Lord Brockett's estate, and Lord Brockett was known to have been something of the then Lord Brockett of a Nazi sympathiser, so we felt fully entitled to poach his deer. And some sort of very long, taxing 2 or 3 days in the hills and mountains there. And I remember they'd all rather looked askance at Edward Beddington Behrens, because I suppose he was in his 40s. But I remember one very long 2 day outing, and everybody was wondering, they were all wondering how he's going to get on, this chap. He performed far better than most of us did. So they rather changed their tune about Edward Beddington Behrens, who then became a great friend of mine and all that, but that's another story.
Did you have much to do with David Niven?
No, not much. No. He was a rather different generation. But he was an amusing chap. But that was the commando training, and then I rejoined our commando. We were then at Inverary. And it was all pretty grueling. This is sort of the autumn of 40. And then at Largs, where we did quite a lot of sea stuff on the Clyde. I nearly very much drowned myself once in the on the Clyde at late at night on something on the Cumbries. And then on the Isle of Arran. And there we, the three Glen ships were there, which had been designed, you know, but converted for this sort of stuff, commando stuff at the war. And Keyes then used to come up, Admiral. That is Admiral Keyes, Admiral Keyes of Zeebrugge fame, who had been, who had really asked and got himself appointed as... I don't think it was called Chief of Combined Operations, but it was what Chief of Combined Operations became by Churchill. Of course, it was an old pal of his, and he used extreme pressure on Churchill to secure this appointment. And he was always pressing, of course, for the engagement of the commandos. There were now, I don't know how many there were in the UK, but there were three or four training in the Isle of Arran. One of the things which he was keen on was the attack on Pantelleria near Malta, but there were other, lots of other schemes. He was, but all of them fell through. We spent some time in Arran, and again, it was pretty arduous training, but the old boys, the grandees of the commando, did pretty well, and they got their grand wives up, and very pleasant.
But was there a sense of frustration because of all the delay into getting into action?
I think we were getting a little bit fidgety. But then, we had leave over Christmas, and it was embarkation leave, in fact, because we knew then we were going out to the Middle East. So there was quite a lot of excitement of that. And it was very good company. I mean, we had some very interesting and amusing people there joined us. There was, the trip out, which I remember very well, the usual marvelous time in Cape Town. But we were joined on board there. Well, Evelyn Waugh had joined the commando then. Old Admiral Cowan, who used to command the Mediterranean fleet, he'd come out as an observer. But in fact, he was very actively engaged. He was in the desert when he was captured there. Peter Beattie, son of the Admiral, he was a naval officer, he was part of it. It was an amusing crowd, and I think by then we thought that we were going to be actively involved.
Did Evelyn Waugh fit into things? Because
not really,
from his
novels,
he gives the impression that he didn't.
I don't think he did really fit into things, but I think he became much more of a misfit later on, I think. I saw a bit of Evelyn Waugh after the war. He was a great, great friend of my father-in-law, my second wife you've met, her father. And in fact, the last thing of his diary is a very moving paragraph about the death of Phil Dunn, as he called him. But he never really fitted in, although I think he did extremely well in Crete with Bob Laycock and was extremely brave. There's no doubt about that at all. But he wasn't really suited for this type of thing, nor indeed was Randolph. But of course it was helpful having Randolph Churchill in the commando. It meant that views were received at a very high level.
So you went round the Cape to...
We went round the Cape up to the Canal Zone. We were then... we were destined for an operation which was involving a division as well for something which was always extremely close to Winston's heart, and that was the capture of Rhodes, which he saw as the key to the Aegean, the key perhaps to persuading the Turks to come into the war, and then perhaps